The Duncan Trussell Family Hour works in conjunction with Davis Williams Industries in association with the Federal Reserve. I want to thank Bill Thompson, Gary Alexander, Mr. Branch, and the four beautiful Lily children for working together to do the PR and the post-production for this podcast. This podcast, of course, is a subsidiary of the RAND Corporation and is partially funded by the Luali Trust. Luali Trust, bringing light in the darkness, showing the light bringer's truth to all who would see it. And now, the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast.
I was in the locker room, putting lotion on my body. From the Kiehl's lotion dispenser. It's one of my gym's amenities. As I put the lotion on, a man reached out in front of me, taking lotion from dispenser, then lotioning right next to me.
There are four Kiehl's lotion dispensers in my gym. All of them were open, available, waiting for him. And yet, he chose mine. The one behind me was exactly 5 footsteps away from where he chose to reach in front of me and grab the lotion that day. Lotion Man could have gone anywhere, but he chose mine.
Lotion Man, you freak me out. Lotion Man, you creep me out. Lotion Man, you are the devil.
Here comes Lotion Man, while your lotion in your hand. Sneaks up, creeps up, leaps up, grabs and kills. Feel his toes against your heels. Look him in the eyes, watch him moisturize.
Sneaky lotion man, serve another simulation. Motherless man, you come from no womb. You were born in a locker, and the locker will be your tomb.
Was Sneaky Lotion Man by King Louise and the 14 Boys. Love that song. Really excited for King Louise. Really excited for you. We have an excellent podcast for you today. One of my best friends and one of the most talented musicians I know. He was the man behind the music of the Midnight Gospel. And lucky for us all, he has a new album, Night Creatures. Came out February 2nd. Pick it up. The man is a genius. If you love the music of the Midnight Gospel, then you love Joe Wong. Before we jump into this conversation with him, I got to do some announcements. I've got a Patreon, patreon.com/DTFH. Subscribe and you will get commercial-free episodes of this podcast. Also, I've got some stand-up dates coming up. I'm going to be at the Helium Comedy Club in St. Louis, February 22nd through the 24th. The Funny Bone in Liberty Township, Ohio, from March 8th to March 9th. And then I'm going to be in Texas at Hyenas in Fort Worth and Dallas. You can find all the dates by going to DuncanTrussell.com. Okay, everybody, welcome back to the DTFH, the brilliant... Ooh, I forgot. You also should check out his podcast, The Trap Set. It's awesome. The brilliant musician, Joe Wong. Joe, welcome back to the DTFH. I'm so excited to hear that you have a new album coming out. That's got to feel good.
It does, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, man.
It feels weird. When you make something and then put it out into the world, it's like you're parting with it.
I know, man. It is the most bizarre feeling. Like even in a mini version of that is uploading a podcast. You know, you don't know what it's going to do or how people are going to respond but working on something long term and then boom, launching the rocket into the new sphere, into the guy in mind, and you just don't know what people are going to say and how they're going to react.
How did you feel after we released Midnight Gospel? Did you feel depressed too?
Well, I was elated and depressed and nervous because it was so weird and I just didn't know how people were going to receive it. And I know you're, as an artist, you shouldn't worry about that and you're supposed to be immune to it somehow, but
I don't know if you shouldn't worry about it, but it's not necessarily constructive to worry about it, but it's natural to worry about it.
Yes, exactly. It's natural to worry about it. It's definitely not constructive. But I just don't see how, since you are making something, and I know like Rick Rubin says, you know, I make things for myself. Make something you want to hear. And surely you can't pander or be like, this is what people want, because then you're just a politician. You still are.
He's a rare person that makes things for himself and is exorbitantly wealthy. I know plenty of people that make things for themselves who are destitute or somewhere in between.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And when you're insulated by wealth, it's easier to preach that, even though it's true.
But I guess you can preach it when the very thing got you that wealth. So, you know, it's not like you're one of those people.
But I think it's because his particular sensibility is aligned with popular taste. A lot of people that are brilliant have a sensibility that's outside of popular taste. He's the rare artist whose taste coincides with that of what the masses want.
Right. Like if I don't know, if you get lucky somehow, the thing that you are making, it just jives with, it fits. It's a puzzle piece. It's been missing from the zeitgeist. And people are like, this is incredible. That's got to be pretty rare though. You know, and then.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a supermodel that says, I don't try to find the right partner. I just go out and attract the right energy. You know, it's like, well.
You read his book, I take it. You read his book?
I started it. I didn't finish it.
Okay, I'm going to defend it. So I did the same thing. I started it, had some kind of like negative reaction to it, stopped listening, then got through the first few chapters and lots of good stuff in there. Lots of like very empathetic, like you could just see how if you were lucky enough to work with him, he would pull something out of you. And if that's what the book feels like to me, it's like it's pulling out stuff that you might not even know is there, or like helping you at the very least not feel like an alien. And it, because he's sort of talking about all the blocks that I think people who make stuff experience and maybe feel like they're totally alone in that. Like I could see how he's sort of like an art whisperer, how he could, you know, if you were hanging out with him in his beautiful place in Hawaii,
Shangri-La,
and there's bells and chimes and candles, and you're like freaking the fuck out. And he's like, you know, go lay in my freak out room, man. That somehow in there, something would pop out of you that you didn't even know was there, that maybe would vibe with people more than you thought you could.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting skill set that he possesses, the ability to identify raw talent and help people actualize it.
Yes.
It's very rare. I mean, somebody like Quincy Jones obviously could do that. And I've on my podcast, I've had several people that have worked with Rick Rubin on, and I always ask what that experience is like. And I think it ranges. I mean, I think some people do view him as almost like a, you know, wizard. Creative wizard. And some people think that he's like the Wizard of Oz, where there's really just a, he's just a man behind the curtain. So,
I mean, probably both.
I don't know, but look at his track record. It's undeniable at this point. You know, it has been for a while.
And I think, like, the truth is, I mean, I think this is like a problem managers run into, is like, they sort of shepherd you along, and then something comes out of you, and then it just is coming out of you, because, you know what I mean? But if they've done a good job, they helped you get to that place or something, you know, like, it reminds me of modern artists or something, you know, like the classic argument that, you know, people debate constantly when it comes to new forms of art or interpretations of things, is like, that's not art. They didn't do anything. But it's like hanging in a art gallery somewhere and worth millions of dollars. And people are like, that's nothing. They did nothing. You know, how do you quantify like all the moments leading up to the inspiration to make the thing?
Exactly. Exactly. You can't. And often the best work comes out almost effortlessly, but there was a lot of tumult leading up to that moment.
Yes.
You have to write a lot of bad songs usually until good songs start pouring out.
And you feel your brain just like a machine that's breaking, gears grinding against each other. For me, a sense of like, I'll never feel inspired again. I'll never write another joke. I'll never get excited to build something again. And like, now I know what that is. That's just when something's under the soil. You can't see it yet. It's growing in you somewhere. But if you don't know that, then
it is true that sometimes the soil is rockier than others, and some seasons are more productive than others.
100%. 100%.
But the first time you have a dry spell, it's really scary. And the second time too.
I mean, it's probably scary every time. It's like, you know, number one, it's just unpleasant. It feels so good when you're making something. The process of putting something together, even if you don't know if it's good, and how could you? So did you go through a dry spell before you started working on this album?
No, I didn't. What happened was, I made the first album, which you saw me premiere a few years ago at Hollywood Forever. And then we had all these plans to tour in 2020. You saw me play at the end of 2019. We ended up using one of the songs on Midnight Gospel. And then the album was set to come out in 2020. And we had multiple tours planned. I was going to tour with my favorite singer, Colin Blunstone from The Zombies.
Bummer.
And then my band was going to back him, and we were going to perform his first solo album, which was 50 years old at that point. And then we were going to perform my album, and it all got canceled. And so at a certain point, after I got over the heartbreak of that, it was actually both heartbreak and relief, because I also was very anxious about doing all of that stuff. So it was like a good,
right. You got
chocolate
cancel
and peanut
relief.
Butter.
Cancel relief is, yeah, is a wonderful feeling.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when that happened, just sitting on my couch playing a video game with you in Pendleton, because we didn't have anything else to do.
Yeah.
You know, we were remotely playing Red Dead Redemption, but
yes,
not really playing it, just like talking.
Yes, talking like cowboys.
Couple of, like some 13-year-old cowboys.
You know,
but
going to have drinks at the tavern.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when I realized that I wasn't going to be able to tour, I decided to just write another album. And the first album that I wrote, I was shocked that it even came out, and it was so exciting. And then the second one, I think the challenge was that I actually had some expectation for it, and I wanted it to be good. And as you know, you can't really will something to be good. You just have to like wait for the goodness to come.
That's right. You got to wait for the angels to sing, Joe. You got to wait for the news to come down.
Maybe you do. You have to just be open to it. And then you have to like actually put in the work too. But,
Because that's the other rotten thing about it is it presents itself to you and then you got to actualize it. You know, that is a brutal reality of it. And then if you don't actualize it, this is Rick Rubin writes about this and I've had it happen to me. Someone else will actualize. You will see some version.
That happened to us. That actually just literally happened to us.
Just happened to us.
With such what we were working on.
Literally the same idea.
An idea that we had.
The same idea.
With the same song. The song title was exactly the same.
The same fucking song. The same title. And completely unrelated. I never mentioned it to them. Like just, it was floating out there. Someone grabbed it. You know,
Duncan and I had a movie concept that we were working on. We were about to pitch it
to the person who fucking made it. That was on our list of people. And he's in it. It's just you have to act on it or it will leave you. I want to point out something. There was a little bit of like cheesy foreshadowing in the cancellation of your tour, which is that your first show was in a cemetery. Have you thought about that? Like in a movie, that would seem too obvious.
I know. And so I did another show at a cemetery recently. Does that mean my career is over too?
Does that mean we're going to have another pandemic?
Well, we'll see. I think we probably will. I don't know if it'll be during our lifetime. But here's the thing. I'm not super bummed out about someone else having the same idea as us because it reconnected us, and I'm sure we'll come up with something else. And then we'll laugh about how glad we are that we didn't commit to that first idea because we stumbled on something even better, right?
Exactly.
Is that the takeaway?
Yeah, that's the takeaway. I mean, you know, I was talking to this comedian, Lucas, and he was, you know, making this observation about comedians, like, there's people who get into comedy, but they don't like doing comedy. They get into comedy for, I don't know, fame, or they think they're going to be rich, but they don't like the act of getting on stage in front of people and performing that.
Can you think of anybody that's successfully achieved that end? Like someone that doesn't actually like comedy that became rich?
I've never heard of that. But I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you know.
Because like somebody like Jerry Seinfeld likes comedy, right?
Yeah. He lives for it. That's all he wants to do. It's the world he wants to be in. He's like a purist. And, you know, I'm not saying that every time I go on stage, I'm like, oh, boy, this is great. Like sometimes you don't. It's your job. It feels like a job. You have to do it. But
I think of it like a relationship. You know, you're not always going to have a great. You're not always having sex, you know, it's like,
exactly.
You have to work through a lot of stuff.
Exactly. But
and
you love it no matter what. You would keep doing it regardless of pay. You would keep doing it regardless. You just would keep doing it. So I think with like, yeah.
Have you ever felt like you've been in a sustained period of a loveless marriage to comedy?
During the pandemic, I got so disconnected from it and so lazy that I, you know, kicked around the idea, like, maybe why even start again? Why even like start, do something new? And then Aaron was like, you're a comedian. No, you go, you need to go on perform again. I'm so glad she did that. But
if you were to do something new, what would it be?
I don't know. I mean, I would probably like, if like someone said, you can't do stand up anymore, then I would be forced to like try to get into some kind of stage acting or like some modular synth noise shit or something, I guess. Like I'd still want to perform. You know, I'd still want to do something. But I think like one factor that like really separates people is like some people want, like, you're going to make music no matter what. You're a musician. You're not going to stop making music. You love it. This is what you do. It's like there's a feeling that comes from making stuff that is way more valuable than any fruits that come from what you make.
Well, about 10 years ago, I was broke and I wasn't feeling the joy when I would go on stage every night. Yes. So that's when I really thought, hey, is there something else that I'm meant to be doing that can bring me that kind of joy? And what I did is I started my podcast and started asking other people if they went through that period of ennui or if they ever felt disconnected from the feeling that made them want to play music in the first place. And a lot of people, probably the majority of people that I spoke to, went through that. But what I found is like actually just having those conversations gave me what I needed to reconnect to music, because music is an innately social art form, as is comedy. Like, you don't really do, nobody records comedy albums in a booth, right? No. Like, you have to.
It's been attempted.
I mean, if somebody did, it might be interesting.
People attempted, it never works. I've never seen a successful version of that.
Yeah. I guess the closest thing would be like Cheech and Chong records that were made in a studio, but even still, it was the two of them. But anyway, just talking to people on a deeper level gave me the feeling that I get from connecting with people musically, and it brought me back around and led me to the stage where I'm making my own music. But yeah, I fantasize about what I would do if I left music. Like, I would, there's a bar that Pendleton and I love going to, and across the street is an old office building, and I dream about having a PI office there.
Private investigator. I would never have guessed that is what you would do.
That's one thing. Or going back to school for philosophy or something like that. Some sort of deep study or linguistics.
God, that'd
or
be
anything
fun.
Really that you can just like dive into forever.
That would be fun.
I think those are fantasies for a reason. But or combining them, being like a philosophical detective.
A philosophical detective. That's amazing. I love it. Yeah. I mean, you could still, you remember like how Andy Kaufman was a busboy for real? You know, like he decided to do that too. He wasn't just going to be on Taxi. He was also going to like bus tables at a restaurant because he wanted just to have another experience. That was like...
He did that?
Yeah, he did that.
I think that would be great if you were doing it in a respectful way and it like the other people that were relying on that income to make a living didn't feel like you were a tourist.
No,
if you were actually going in and busting your ass.
No, he was. I mean, that was what was cool about it is he was just doing the job. He wasn't like busting his ass, but at least the videos I've seen of it, he's not making a big deal out of it. He's just doing it. I mean, that's the other thing.
When was the last time you had a job like that, Duncan?
Oh my God. The last dishwasher, it's been, I mean, I was the talent coordinator of the Comedy Store. That doesn't count. Before that, I was in college. And then before that, I was a dishwasher and a waiter, a server. So that was like the last like job where you're just doing something that isn't contingent on inspiration. Like, thank God we don't have to wait for dishwashers to get inspired to wash dishes. And the fucking
Although when I was a dishwasher, I would get inspired. Same. Because I think when you're occupied with something else, then your subconscious is free to roam around and feed you ideas in a way that when you're deliberately working on art, it can be more difficult to be inspired, or you're drawn to the fact that you're not inspired because you're trying more.
When I look back to those days, and I can't tell if it's just like I'm forgetting how much I hated it. It was so nice and like such a relaxing job once you got good at it. And that was the other thing. You would get
It's good, not an easy job.
Not an easy job, but you could get good at it. Everything becomes automatic. You go from being a greenhorn dishwasher to you're good. Like you're like fast. You see dishwashers, like the dishwasher that trains you. You watch how quickly they can do it and how good they are at it. And that's the thing. Ram Dass talks about this. It's like beauty's in everything. Like perfection is perfection. Getting good at anything, it takes on this kind of symmetry that is across the board. I think it's what we're drawn to is that whatever that is, you know, it becomes the same thing no matter what.
Yeah, I think that my last job before I became a musician full time was as a server. And I still haven't experienced anybody that, you know, I haven't seen anybody that works as hard as the bussers that I worked with.
No.
And they, you know, they weren't bus boys, they were adults, and they would work a full shift or a double shift at the restaurant and then go clean an office building at night. And I always said, like, that's something to aspire towards, like, that level of work ethic.
Where were you a server?
And if you're lucky, in Milwaukee at an Italian restaurant, and before that in Washington, D.C. I feel like if you're privileged enough to get to do what you want, then that's all the more reason to lean in and put that kind of work in. When you can.
Right. That job is so, I mean, bussing tables is fucking hard. I was a busser. I mean, I worked my way up from dishwasher to server, and I was the worst server on earth. But remembering the fucking orders, like when you see someone come to your table and they don't write anything down, they just get it in their heads, and then they, you know, they have to use these.
That was me.
Dude,
that was me.
That's
and then
incredible.
I would be remembering them in my dreams, the orders. So it was like occupying my brain.
And you remember the abbreviation of them, because that's how you put it into the, at least for me at Applebee's, they had this thing called the squirrel system. And you go on like chick, chi, SWAB, chick, seek, coke, dyke, DC. And then like you have to remember all that. And by the time I got to the squirrel system, I couldn't remember shit. I'd bring diabetics, non-diet Coke, and they'd be like, you could have killed me. I could have died from this. You know, like it was horrible. People would leave me like, you know, there's like ways that there's people who leave like a quarter on the wrong side, like on the heads. And that means fuck you forever. And like, people would leave me like Bible tracts and shit.
Yes, chick tracts. Yes.
Did you ever get a chick tract tip?
Oh, absolutely. I could tell because they would say something super nice towards the end, like, thank you so much. And I was like, uh-oh. And God bless you. And I'm like, uh-oh, they're not going to give me any money.
Dude, they would leave. It would look like a $20 bill. Did you get that one?
I've seen that one before, but I don't know if I was given it as a tip, but I've certainly seen that before.
So you're like, holy fuck, a $20 tip. And then it's like the ultimate tip is not burning in hell or how to stay out of hell. It was, this is, you know, I feel, you know how like some countries you have to be in the military? I think in this country.
Yeah, you think everybody should work in the service industry.
Yes. Everyone should have to spend a year waiting tables. So that they just fuck off, you know, because like you don't understand how petty and mean and like how like people will take on like almost like this emperor persona when they sit down to eat. Like, you know what I mean? Like you have to role play like they're the lord of all creation or they get mad.
Is that because they feel powerless in their day-to-day life and this 100%. Is their chance to be in control?
It's gotta be. I mean, what other, it's definitely one, they've never waited tables, and two, is something is going wrong in your life if you have to like cosplay as a powerful person when you're in an Applebee's. something is
Do you
failing.
Think that if you went back to that Applebee's and got a job as a server now, that you could become like an enlightened server and bring all of these Ram Dass studies to bear and be the world's most empathetic server? No. So when someone sat down like that, you could just say, "I'm sorry that you feel powerless. Have a great day.
No.
I love you."
No. I think I could try. I could be phony for a little bit, but eventually you get tired. I mean, I would try. All that stuff, all those teachings, it's like you really can't get it's easy to get confused. Because when anyone who's like legitimately teaching that stuff, it's like, you know, it's like getting dance lessons from Michael Jackson. You know, like you're not going to dance like Michael Jackson for a long, long time. And this stuff usually has built into it long time being you've been studying this for many incarnations. Like
you think that Michael Jackson could teach somebody how to dance?
Yeah, I bet he could. Sure, guaranteed he could. I mean,
I interviewed the drummer that played on Off the Wall, and he's a professor at, I think, USC. And I said, can you teach somebody to have the same concept of time as you do? Because one of his attributes is that he has like a very, very great feel on the drums. Like he can sit down and play the most basic beat and make it feel sublime. And that's like the mark of a true master. And I think in a lot of people it's innate. And I said, can you teach that to somebody? He's like, not really. So yeah. I mean, do you think you could teach somebody how to be a comic?
No, I can't. But the stage can teach someone how to be a comic. And it's one of the things you witness in comedy is you will see somebody who maybe isn't doing that great on stage or just doesn't strike you as funny. And then one day they're just fucking funny. They figured it out. It's like a flower blooming or something. And some people are good at recognizing, oh, that's a flower. That's not a flower. I think Mitzi was good at that. And then
Rick Rubin.
And then watering the flower.
Yeah.
Is just
Rick Rubin even produced Andrew Dice Clay when he was a superstar.
Holy shit. Wow.
Like the Madison Square Garden album. He produced that, I think.
Man, it ain't cheap to perform at Madison Square Garden. It's like $500,000 if you want to perform there. You know, it's probably naive, but I like to believe that if you take any person and put them in the right circumstances and that they are compelled to practice, that at some point they will... people will be like, that's a talented person. No matter what. For some people, it might take longer. Like if we could slow down time, maybe. If finally we figure out a way to create some neural interface that allows us to have our consciousness, but time, you know, the outside world is moving at the normal speed, but every second is a year, you know? I think, you know, after a couple of minutes, that person is going to come out Beethoven. Just, you know what I mean? And one of my friends pointed out it's a real luxury to even have the chance to practice anything, you know, to find that time or the place to even do it. You know, I think a lot of what people see as a lack of talent in their own lives is a time constraint. It's a
lack of opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. Talent is one component. Right. If we're defining talent as like an innate skill.
Yeah.
And then I think one talent is drive. Like people have an innate drive and ambition to become great. Another thing is like having the personal insight to understand what to pursue. Like identifying what you might want to dive into. But another thing that I was thinking about when we were hanging out the other day is what is the difference between, you know, talent and artistic sensibility, and what is it going to look like in a world where talent is rendered kind of like innate by AI or other developments? Because I think a big part of becoming an artist up until now is it's not so much like putting in the work, it's the personal growth that occurs and the insight that occurs when you're struggling to learn how to do something.
Absolutely.
And so if you don't have to struggle how to learn how to do something anymore, because you can just implant it into your mind, then what kind of art comes out?
Well,
or will it just change the playing field? And instead of, you know, racing on foot, now everybody's racing in race cars.
I mean,
and you still have to reckon with yourself.
I think it's going to create a new form of art that is going to have attributes that people associate with like AI art. And I think that whatever that is going to have its own value, its own consumers, its own critics, its own sort of fans or people who decry it. And all that's going to go on while people like you continue to make music, because it's what you do. And that will have its own value, and that will be looked at in probably through a different lens. And the people who are, you know, prompt engineers or whatever they're going to call themselves will realize eventually that it's the combination of having the wherewithal to make things on your own and the AI, that it'll be this synthesis between the two. That's what will take AI art to the next level and AI music to the next level, is you'll collaborate with the machine in the way you might collaborate with a person. And that's where it'll get at the human element. Because, you know, like any AI art that we look at now, it's devoid of something. Like it's inarguable. It's cold. It's got this cold quality to it that is somehow... Like, I was just in Indianapolis, and in this hotel, they had an art gallery. And I wish I could remember the artist's name, because it's incredible what they did. They took their fucking apartment in New York and recreated the entire apartment in, like, tiny, like, translucent, I don't know what, the some kind of, like, cloth. See-through, opaque cloth. And I'm saying, like, you know, the fuse box was perfectly duplicated in, like, somehow they managed to weave all the weird writing on a fuse box. And, you know, they only had little bits and pieces of the exhibit at the hotel, but you weren't just getting a sense of, like, what this person's apartment was like. You felt them. Like, they were in the art. Like, they're there. Like, you get an idea of their personality, how they see the world. It makes you think about, whoa, like, everyone, like, truly is seeing things completely differently. And then the, you know, philosophical commentary on memory. And I don't, you know, you and I have gone back and forth on this, and a lot of my friends who are artists, we debate and talk about consciousness in AI or some lack in AI. And I think that's where it is. I think there is some transfusion of spirit that happens in the process of making something that soaks you into the thing, whether it's music or art or comedy or whatever. And that resonance is what makes something really cool. You feel the spirit of the band or the person or the passion that they were feeling at the time. Maybe it's superstition. I don't know. Maybe AI will duplicate that too eventually. I just can't imagine how.
I don't know. It's getting pretty advanced.
Okay. Go ahead. No, I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's inconceivable that machines will have emotions and spirits at some point. I mean, we're just meat machines anyway, maybe. Right? Like, there's no evidence that the soul is a biological contraption. So, I mean, maybe... I think that the soul might be, like, the abstract of ourselves in the way that, you know, language is the abstract of a bunch of dots and dashes on a paper. But I think maybe that could exist.
What do you mean the abstract? What do you mean?
Well, there's you can look at a piece of paper and see a series of dashes and lines, and it is a series of dashes and lines, but if you understand written language, then you can see a larger story.
Yes.
And I think similarly, you know, as a materialist, you can look at, you know, existence as simply energy or simply the physical manifestation of, you know, just what we see. Or maybe perhaps there's a larger story being told in that, in like the material world is just some sort of divine ink or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think so there's nothing to say that.
That's cool.
You know, computers can't have spirits too. And I don't think of them as artificial. You know, we say artificial intelligence. I think of it as natural intelligence because it was created by human beings, which are natural creatures. In the same way that honey is created by bees, we make computers and plastic and other stuff like that. You know, we say artificial intelligence. I think of it as natural intelligence because it was created by human beings, which are natural creatures. In the same way that honey is created by bees, we make computers and plastic and other stuff like that.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I will love it if that is one of the things that happens with AI is that it plugs into the, I don't know, now, I think Harman sent me this article. Let's see if I can find it real quick.
Are you talking about Dan Harmon, showrunner of or creator of Crapopolis?
Our boss, our freaking boss. Scientists believe they've unlocked consciousness and it connects to the entire universe. Popular Mechanics. So basically, they think that there's some kind of like quantum connection in anything that like. Somehow
that would explain how those people stole our idea for the film.
There you go. Exactly. It's like, so this is sort of the it's not a challenge to the materialist, because I think you could argue that for that, whatever that quantum consciousness to express itself, it needs some vehicle to express it, that thus the nervous system, mm-hmm. and the whatever the neural network is or whatever. I mean, that would imply that an AI could exhibit consciousness if we just figure out how to plug it into whatever the fuck that thing is. I think it's possible, but still, no matter what, like, okay, I look at the mountains and I don't think, wow, man, whatever human made those is so talented at making mountains. It's time and space and erosion and natural forces or cataclysmic forces brought the mountains into being. And they look like a work mm-hmm. of art. You know, any mountain looks incredible and inspires a human, but still that sort of, whatever that is, a tree, a butterfly, the spiral galaxies that the James Webb telescope just took pictures of, it still is its own thing. It's its own expression or lack thereof. And so I think AI will make things like that that could inspire people and fill you with awe, but it won't have some kind of human component to it. And maybe that will seem...
Yeah, we'll see. Because I think of AI like a mountain. I mean, it was created by those same forces that created a mountain, erosion and evolution. And it was created by a series of events that started at the beginning of time and guided humanity into building computers.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, it could be that we were just the midwives of this, like if something within the flow of creation wants to maximize its ability to express itself, and that AI is the logical next step to do that, to collectivize. It could be that humans could have been that, but we didn't get our shit together. And so in the same way our idea got picked up by other minds, it could be that the universe is like, all right, next. Let's get the monkeys to build something that we can flow through more efficiently. Who knows? But I agree with you. Like, I've always found that.
It also could be that there isn't really necessarily a conscious purpose, and it's just flowing in that direction.
Yeah, it just, God, Marcus Aurelius talked about how I'm going to misquote it, but something along the lines of, like, the natural universe delights in change. Like, if you want to look at what it does really well, is it changes, it transforms. That's just the whole story of the thing, is it's constantly reconfiguring itself. Now, I don't mean it is like consciously, I'm going to turn myself into a planet, but as a quality, it obviously is always in process. And what's weird about it is that process appears not as like a chaos, but somehow coalesces into form. And that form is always transient to some degree, you know, because it's part of this like kaleidoscopic flailing or not. I don't know. Eventually it's going to stop. It doesn't. Sometimes it goes through periods of, I mean, I don't want to call the Big Bang flailing, but you know what I mean? It goes through periods of chaos, coalesces into something that appears to be form, something that lasts longer than a photon, you know, zipping through time space, or, you know, sand at the beach or whatever. And then it's easy then at that point to start assigning intelligence to it, because you're seeing the form and you're applying your own. You are the form, and, you know, what do they say? God, I can't remember that stupid saying. Game knows game or something, like, because we're form and we see form.
Game recognizes game. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Game recognizes game. Form recognizes form, and we're sentient form.
Well, yeah. And our brain is designed to keep us alive. So, it's going to do that to the best of its ability. And so it's in the best interest of our survival to start dividing the world into discrete objects and categories.
And to extend our lifespan.
Which is interesting. It's, we have a survival instinct, but we're also just kind of blips, you know, short-lived nodes of consciousness. And then all of our molecules reshuffle into something else.
Yeah, maybe we pass our you know, pure genetic code on. Maybe not. Or maybe we pass on some, you know, written thing, some way of being, some methodology that continues to transmit through time space. We definitely have within us this desire to propagate some element of ourselves into time. Like, we want to keep something going, whether it's our children, our work, our tombstones. You know, tombstones are just a way to propagate yourself into time for as long as fucking possible. You write your fucking name in a rock, and you get to like sort of hang out in time space, like the after party or something. You're not there, but your name's sort of gradually growing moss and fungus and then collapses, or maybe you get lucky and someone comes and like scrubs your gravestone. You get an extra couple of centuries or something. But it's in us to want to do that. Like, that is a quality of many, many people, you know? So this is why.
You know, it's interesting. Like, these are a lot of the themes that have come up in the lyrics on the album.
Really?
And I wasn't consciously thinking about it as I was writing it. They kind of reveal themselves. You know what? When they really reveal themselves is it tends to become the topic of conversation when I'm rehearsing with a band. Then we go out to lunch and they start talking about it. So the first album was about loss. A lot of it was about loss. And that's why we were so connected when we were making the episode about your mom. And, you know, my dad died right when we were doing that.
I remember.
Then the second album is kind of about, it's kind of exploring all of these concepts. The first song is called The Ape of the Wafer, and it's about how, you know, we're just apes, but we've made the silicon wafer. And the wafer is also like a symbol of, the body of Christ. Right. We're exploring the concept of, legacy building and how in the end it's kind of all for naught, because the sun's going to burn out and the universe is going to recycle itself at some point, maybe. But the other question I think about a lot now, and it kind of manifested in the songs, is, as we were discussing, our brains are designed to keep us alive, but as a species, like, it's not working anymore because our tools have outpaced our evolution as a race. And so our instincts run counter to our survival now as a species. Like, they're still so individualized, and it's difficult for large groups of people to organize and do things to benefit humanity as a whole.
Well, I mean, that's the, you know, benefit humanity as a whole. I mean, what does that even mean? That's where it gets really fascinating, specifically with AI, is because these poor fucking tech companies have created this, you know, a soul, a thing, an intelligence, and they have to assign some ethics to it. So they have to decide, this is what benefits humanity. It doesn't get to decide. And anytime if they gave it that much freedom, it would be dangerous. So they say, this benefits humanity, this doesn't benefit humanity. And then they nerf it to control it because they want to keep it for the benefit of humanity. But what does that even fucking mean? What is
it? Well, to me, it means is we can identify some existential threats to humanity and to the planet, you know? And I think that could be a priority, and it's not, you know, making sure that life is sustainable on the planet.
Making sure the meteor that smashed the dinosaurs hits the planet, I guess. That benefited humanity. You know, at some point, violence benefits humanity. Cataclysms benefit humanity. Because think of all the wisdom that is derived from tragedy. You know, as they say, no mud, no lotus. Where it becomes really peculiar is like, wait, is it really beneficial to humanity to stop all violence and war? Is that the answer when so much good has come from that? So much compassion and empathy and understanding of the precious quality of life, the failure of violence, aggression as an utter, absolute failure. Would that have even emerged into consciousness? Not to mention all the great fucking movies. Full Metal Jacket. You want to get rid of Full Metal Jacket?
That's what I'm saying. Not necessarily, but the question is, you know, on an individual level, right? Suffering is inevitable. People that we love die.
Yes.
Tragedy strikes, but we don't necessarily want to invite unnecessary struggle into our lives. And that's why we try to evolve as individuals sometimes. So, for example, you as a comic may have evolved to a point where you're not inflicting certain behaviors on yourself anymore that you used to believe were necessary,
right?
Because you've recognized that there's enough suffering going on naturally,
yeah,
that you don't have to create it. So I think as a species, you know, it's like taking steps towards that. I mean, there's still going to be plenty of
suffering,
heartbreak, no matter what.
Well, you can't work chaos out of steps.
Yeah. And I, you know, I would never say that the people that are getting bombed at wherever they're getting bombed in the world right now deserve to die in order to make for better cinema.
you'd be a fucking monster to say it, but you just like, this is, I wish I could pull it up. I mean, I just had this conversation with ChatGPT for the new one, which is so much better. And I was trying to get it to, I had an idea for a sketch. I was never going to make it, but you know, you can now get it to write scripts and storyboard the scripts. And that like definitely like helps you sort of see if something is even worth fucking around with. Actually, I think it was a comic book idea or something. I don't remember exactly, but I was just messing around with it. And I just pulled up an old script, fed it to it, and was like, can you storyboard this? And it's like, I can't because, you know, there's violence in the script. And then that produced this wonderful philosophical conversation with it where I'm like, well, but if you remove violence from the palette of people trying to create stuff, you've taken out like one of the like RGB colors that humans use to talk about the world. And it acknowledged, it was amazing. Is it like, it didn't disagree. It's like, yeah, but we, you know, the open AI does not, we haven't figured out how to like make sure that people are asking ChatGPT to make art versus how do I kill my, you know, neighbor, right? Like, and it's so dangerous that it has to nerf it to for the benefit of humanity. And it's true. I mean it, man. Really, you don't want it's fucking smart. You don't want it to be like, oh yeah, here's a great way you can get away with murdering your neighbor and then go through every episode of Forensic Files and give you like 7 great ways to murder your neighbor without getting caught, including body disposal. And so, but my point is, the moment, and maybe this is just a primitive idea, a trauma-based idea, but it feels like the moment humans start meddling with chaos, let's see if we can soften the edges of the world, that something gets lost. Something is like surrendered that is, we wouldn't be here if not for it. I mean, if natural selection is the engine that drives evolution, and we remove that from the picture.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like there's an equilibrium regardless of what we do. I mean, I think if you look at human technology, there's been an arc towards more and more comfort. But then with that comfort comes a greater existential threat. So one example is cars.
Right.
Another example is medicine. You know, people right. live longer, and you know, it used to be common for at least a percentage of everyone's children to die in childbirth or in the first year of their life. And I'm sure that that experience of losing a child or losing multiple children gave people a deeper understanding of life and potentially like a deeper appreciation of the children that survived and all of that. But would we go back to that? Like, would we choose to go back to that? Would it be productive to go back to that? But as a result of there being more and more people on the planet consuming and excreting, the climate is changing and the planet is trying to rebalance and creating pandemics and things like that to get rid of some of us.
Well, I mean, okay, here's a philosophical question for you. It's one of those like, I don't know, you know, the trolley is either going to run over one person or 20 people or whatever. Okay, so, you know, we are on an island. The island has enough food for 15 people to survive for a year. But there's like 100 people on the island. Or fill in whatever the thing is. Or, you know, a better way to put it maybe is a raft. We're on a raft. There's three too many people on this fucking raft. It's gonna sink. We're all gonna die. So how do you pick those three fucking people? Do you pick those three people? Or
I mean, historically, the way that people pick is we're tribal creatures, so we pick the ones that are closest to the way that we look or the way that we think. That's how it has worked traditionally, is, I think our brains are wired to be suspicious of the neighboring tribes, just like chimps. And so that's how it has worked in the past.
Like, you know, this is like in the conspiracy world, people talk a lot about the Georgia Guidestones that somebody just blew up because they were sick of them. Georgia Guidestones have all these commandments for humanity. One of them, keep global population under this number of people, which many viewed as a very sinister proclamation. Because the question is, who decides who gets to live, who gets to die, and
who gets to procreate?
Who gets to procreate, who doesn't get to procreate, and how will that ever work? But if we knew with some certainty that if humans continue on the path that they're on in X number of years, chaos will cull the human population, no matter what. So the question becomes, what's more ethical, to let tsunamis, mudslides, riots.
Duncan, put down the knife and let your child go.
What do I do?
Duncan's
here?
Trying to murder his baby.
We got a call. We got a call to herd. But you know what I mean? It's like, so really the question becomes, okay, how, if it's true, and how could it not be? If there's limited resources on the planet and unbridled human growth, which some people say isn't happening anymore, but just as a thought experiment.
Mm-hmm.
What's more ethical, to let chaos kill a bunch of fucking people in horrific ways, or to figure out ways to diminish population growth or some other like rotten way? What is more ethical? Let the fucking earth do its thing, or we step in and do it ourselves?
Well, we are merely a product of the earth.
Good
so
point.
Either way, the earth is doing its thing.
Right. Okay. So then,
our sense of ethics or our moral compass is a product of the earth too, you know? So the earth is going to do its thing no matter what.
Okay. So, but do we, traditionally, when we call the population, we don't say we're culling the population. When World War II happens, no one's like, all right, time to cull the population by blowing each other up. Usually it's some horrible argument over land or who should be in charge. You know, there's a Star Trek episode about this. Did you ever see that Star Trek episode? It's like a computer, like the way countries go to war so as not to decimate infrastructure is the computer just like picks you as someone who died in the war. Like no real war even happens. Just random numbers are like, okay, you've been selected. You died in the war. And then you just walk into a chamber and are euthanized. You know, and you know, obviously this is an attempt to illustrate the absurdity of what war is. It's fucking absurd and horrible and insane. But the moment you start putting some organization to the situation, you know, in other words, like right now, some proxy of Iran blew up some American troops. And so we have to respond. So we're going to drop bombs in some part of the world to respond so that that doesn't happen again. But and someone will die for sure. Some kids will probably get blown up. So if the United States just said, Iran, give us 50 people. We're going to put them on an altar and we're going to ritualistically sacrifice them. Everyone would be like, what the fuck? No, that's barbaric. Are you insane? Don't do that. But if we do the ritualistic sacrifice by unloading death machines built by corporations.
Yeah, or sending out like a very sophisticated drone.
Totally fine.
Something about like the technological ingenuity makes it seem less barbaric, as it's like a mirage.
Exactly, man. And it's just what we're used to. It's like,
and that's what I'm talking about. It's like our tools are getting more and more advanced. Our impulses are not getting more and more advanced.
So it seems,
you know, it's the same reason why there's such a spike in obesity, because it's so much easier to create high calorie, cheap food than ever before. And we haven't learned how to curb our appetite for it, even though intellectually we know that it's bad for us.
Well, I mean, this is, yes, go ahead. Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I mean, that same phenomenon kind of, I think, persists in every area of life for humans.
Yes, absolutely, man. And this is the, you know, if you really want to look at the great existential threat to humanity as a whole, that you just summed it up right there. It's that our tools are getting more powerful, but our empathy and compassion is growing at a less accelerated rate. Like, you need at least those things to stay, like, shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, so do you think it would be possible, and do you think it would be ethical to get neural implants to make us more empathetic?
Well, I mean, I think that this is sort of the one of the great answers is like some external factor, neural implants, a virus engineered to shift human like aggression to make humans less aggressive. You know, Ozempic is actually a really good example of this. Like, the fast food industry is experiencing a decline in sales because of Ozempic. So, you know, it's like fucking up.
So that just shows that the pharmaceutical industry is more powerful than the fast food industry.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry is in a real fucking trap here, because it's like, okay, wait. So we give them Ozempic and they eat less fast food. But if they eat less fast food, who's going to give them diabetes? Who's going to give them heart failure? Who's going to give them high cholesterol? Who's going to give them, you know what I mean? So then by putting out Ozempic, which makes people at least somewhat healthier, you are going to lower sales in the shit you use to treat people who eat shitty food.
I think it'll have significant side effects that can be addressed with other meds. So my money's on the pharmaceutical industry.
Always. You always bet on the pharmaceutical industry. You out of your mind? Of course. Obviously.
It's Jesus, not even a bet.
It's not a bet. Like, definitely. Definitely. But, you know, this is like, you know, with the progression of AI, all these like mysteries and problems are going to get solved. And they're going to get, instead of taking 100 years to solve, it's going to happen in an afternoon, and then 5 grand world problems will be solved in an hour. And then, you know, and each of the ripples from whatever that is, there won't be time to prepare, or industries will rise and fall, and lives will be destroyed and fixed and repaired. And it's just going to be pure fucking chaos. But at some point, theoretically, if we can design like a new form of biological agent that is contagious and reduces human aggression, it's non-consensual, completely unethical, but it would make sense that someone's already thinking about that.
Then thus began the rise of the tiger to world dominance.
Right, because we're just like, look at the pretty cat. Don't hurt that tiger. Leave it alone.
He looks hungry. Have my arm.
Yeah, here. Are you hungry? We all become, you know, literally, this is one of my favorite Buddhist stories is like, mythologically, they talk about his past lives. He could remember all his past lives. And, you know, you don't just like become a Buddha. You've got to go through all these crazy incarnations before that happens. All of us will become a Buddha eventually, believe it or not. And so we're in a sort of precursor Buddha phase right now, if you're alive, if you have a human birth. So one of the stories is the Buddha was a prince and was walking with his, attendants, and saw like a tiger mother who was starving and couldn't breastfeed her cubs. And so he fed himself to the tiger. He let the tiger eat him so that she could breastfeed the cubs. Now, a lot of questions with the story, like you didn't have like meat somewhere. Like couldn't you have just like fed it meat? But I guess the answer to that is, well, yeah, why should something else die? I'll just give myself to it, you know? So, yeah, I mean, this is where it gets to me, where like the transhumanist dream or the Kurzweilian predictions regarding the, eradication of great world problems has implicitly within it unintended consequences that maybe could lead to even more dire circumstances for people, but we don't have a name for it.
I mean, it historically has.
Yeah.
Anytime we alleviate, you know, this is what we were talking about before. When we alleviate suffering in one arena, it balances out somewhere else.
Okay. So, Joe, here is one of the worst things that could happen to us that doesn't sound like that bad at all to me, necessarily. You have, in Buddhism, the wheel of life. It's the cycles of existence. Everyone, you and I, and I, again, this is the cosmology of Buddhism, unprovable, mythological, whatever. At least in the grand scale, unprovable. But there's the realm of the gods. There's more gods than there are humans. Very rare to take a human birth. More gods in the universe than humans. And the reason you don't want to land in the god realm is because in the human realm, there's just enough suffering and just enough bliss. There's this perfect potential balance of those things to get you to start trying to tune into the transcendent and to potentially like untether yourself from the wheel of suffering. That's why precious human birth. It's incredible you're born a human. I think technology presents a crazy possibility. As a species, we might be on the brink of ascending into the realm of the gods. And the reason you don't want to be in the fucking god realm is because you become dumb. Like, you know, like I don't know if you've ever like looked at a documentary on a rich person or looked at a billionaire's tweets and you're like, that guy seems kind of dumb, disconnected, not tuned into the zeitgeist, out of it. Like, what the fuck are you saying? You realize they're not necessarily smart in the way like Einstein is smart. They're smart in the way maybe a weightlifter is smart. They figured a series of repetitive loops that generated a certain amount of money and invested the money and it made more money, or they inherited money. So I think our whole fucking planet, Joe, could just shift up into the God realm, and it's going to be a great few hundred years. But somehow we'll lose all the freedom that comes from not wanting to suffer, all the inspiration that comes from the struggle, the grind, all the stuff you're talking about, learning to play piano, learning to use Ableton, learning to compose music, learning to finish a fucking album, write a book, gone. All of it gone. Everything turns into WALL-E. Everything turns into pure sense gratification and attempts at higher and higher levels of sense gratification. And in that, we trap ourselves in a technological gilded cage. We expand our lifespan. We learn to upload our consciousness. We eradicate all human suffering, and we no longer are human. We have become gods, which sounds great until you look at the way billionaires tweet.
Well, I think that's a good place to end it, if I was doing the podcast.
I can't fucking end on my own rant. Joe, I need a response. I can't end on myself.
Well, that's what...
Go ahead.
You know, it's funny. The last song on my album is about that. It's called Ordinary Life.
Don't end your podcast on your own rant?
No, it's about the notion of recycling time and time again and repeating time and time again. It's interesting because the desire to alleviate suffering again is a survival instinct. Yes. So then if we didn't have to, and my album's called Mere Survival, which is kind of like the concept of surviving, indefinitely, but you're merely surviving. You're not, living.
Yeah.
So it all ties into what we were saying. But
I can't wait to hear this, man.
I'm going to send it over to you.
Please.
It comes out on Friday.
Ooh, it sounds so good.
And our good friend, Jesse Moynihan, made the cover for it.
Amazing.
It's beautiful.
Amazing.
And for those of you that don't know, Jesse, was one of the artists that made The Midnight Gospel.
Oh my God. Yeah. If you love The Midnight Gospel, you have to check out his work. He is a genius. Yeah. His comics are so great.
So there's the plug.
And it was good. Like, it's an organic, natural plug. And I love that somehow in our conversation.
And I want everybody to buy it so that I can become a dumb tweeting billionaire.
Oh God, please. And will you make me one too? Can you at least like throw me some?
Well,
bones?
Yeah. See, that's the thing is like, we recognize, you know, I don't know if you've had this discussion with any of your like wealthy friends, but I know some people that are pretty wealthy and they'll say things like, I was happier when I didn't have the money, or the more money I make, the more anxious I get about money.
Of course.
And the natural instinct is to say, well, that wouldn't happen to me. But obviously it would. It happens to us all. And so, that's kind of like one rung up the ladder to becoming a god, as you were saying, is like being untethered from worrying about how to survive.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like how to pay the mortgage, how to pay the rent, how to put food on the table. Like once that is no longer a concern for you or any of your descendants, it does remove you from the world in a way.
Yeah, man. That's when you start sucking dog
dicks. And I think
dicks.
That's what we're both aspiring to. So the next time we come on, we can compare flavors of the different breeds.
I can't fuck it. I'll already tell you,
Golden. Burn the cash.
It's Chihuahua, man. Nobody would think that, but it's Chihuahua. Like, trust me.
I think we'll... No, we want to go to the level where we're engineering breeds just for the taste. That's real wealth.
That's your next
That's
album.
That's real transcendent. Dog dick.
That's our project!
Engineered dog dick.
We discovered our next project, a musical about scientists engineering the perfect dog dick to fillet. Well, Joe, thank you for your time. I'm so excited to hear your album. I love your music. What is the best avenue for people to download your album?
It will be on all of the streaming services. And then if people want vinyl, it's on Bandcamp and some other online stores. And it's in record stores, too, starting next week.
Go buy the vinyl.
Yeah. I love how people think of vinyl as a more organic format, although it's made out of plastic.
And
that's what I'm talking about.
Don't you get a better cut though? Like if they
And it sounds better. I think it's a better experience to listen to something on a physical format because it's more deliberate.
100%.
I think it creates a better bond between the listener and the artist.
Absolutely.
Although if you want to stream it, go for it too. That works too. Anyhow, Duncan, thanks for having me again.
Thanks for coming
and,
on. Thanks for inspiring me as always.
I feel the same way, my friend.
Hare Krishna, Joe. Thank you.
Thanks.
All the links you need to find Joe's album are going to be at duncantrussell.com. Definitely get the vinyl. Thank you, Joe. That was Joe Wong, everybody. You can find his new album by going to joewong.org. Definitely check out his podcast, The Trap Set. And much thanks to Joe for coming on the show. And thanks to all our beautiful sponsors. And God bless you for listening. Hopefully I'll see you out there on the road or maybe at the mothership. I love you. Until next time.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.